from VinePair's New York City headquarters, I'm Adam Teeter.
And in Seattle, Washington, I'm Zach Chabal.
And this is the VinePair podcast. And we're missing Joanna.
We are missing her.
Yeah, and also the Monday one because she's taking a much needed long weekend with the family.
Yeah.
So she's taking off Friday and Monday and Thursday. Good for her.
Yes, yes.
So, yeah, so it's just me and you, man.
Mm-hmm. Well, for a little while.
Yeah, I mean, we have a guest today, but, like, I'm already, like, thinking about Monday. I'm like, man. I don't know. Like, I've been hearing from a lot of people recently. I actually heard from a longtime listener today who emailed in and was like, hey, you know, I'm a longtime listener. I just want to say that I always enjoyed the podcast when it was just you and Zach, but I think it's so much better with Joanna.
I honestly think
I do too, but it's like, okay, yeah. Cool. So, wow, she really improved it that much, huh? Awesome.
Well, I would be surprised if anyone honestly thought it was better before Joanna came, because I would wonder what was possibly wrong with them. But no, I think you know, it's like a triangle is like the most sturdy shape. So yeah, I'm good with that. Not that we can't occasionally make it work with two, but always best with three.
The columns are not as sturdy. True. So what have you been reading on the site?
Speaking of columns, so I think the thing I enjoyed the most, just because I it's such an interesting topic to me, is Rich Manning's piece about upscale, sort of quote unquote upscale dive bars and how they fit into the modern bar landscape. And I think there's a good point in here where Rich is like, wait a second, isn't this just a bar? Like, are, you know, this kind of question of like, I think when I started drinking in bars, I think that, you know, there were fewer kind of places that we would consider kind of craft cocktail bars. You know, this was in the early 2000s. They certainly existed, but they weren't that common. And there was definitely a distinction between the sort of dive bar, right? The place where, you know, it was you're going to get, you know, kind of cheap draft beer, maybe some cheap whiskey or something like that. And you weren't really going for the ambiance. You were going there because the drinks were cheap. And that was kind of the big selling point. And then there were a collection of other bars of various qualities and kind of styles. And obviously the sports bar sort of fits in here somewhere, other things, but they were just bars. You know, we didn't really have a name for them. And now I think it's interesting to think about how, when you've had the bar industry pulled in this one direction, right, towards craft cocktail bars, where you're talking about whatever their aesthetic is, it's, you know, sort of highly thought out drink programs, generally high prices or very high prices, and a kind of aesthetic that can vary, but is bringing in people who really want to be there to, at least in large part, focus on what they're drinking. And you still have dive bars where the kind of the emphasis is the cheap drinking and kind of whatever, the alcohol is just there to kind of help you through the night or whatever. That, yeah, it's created this kind of almost bigger middle ground for all these other kinds of bars to operate that can give you a higher quality beverage. They might be able to meet your cocktail needs more thoroughly than a dive bar would, where you would like never go order a Negroni or a Manhattan or whatever. But we can't just call them bars. I don't know. It was a fun piece. Enjoyed it. How about you?
So I obviously always like our new techniques column. So mm-hmm. I was a huge fan of that. You should read that when you get a chance. But this time, Jack went and spoke with the people behind Schmucks, which is a pop-up that's happening here in New York City at, I think, the Aventi Hotel, in like this space where they also had hosted Angel Share in the past and stuff. And they talk a lot about culinary cocktails and their approach to them, which I thought was really great. And then I also obviously love to see when our tastings team puts together sort of their best lists of the month of the things they were tasting. So this month, the team has been really, so Keith is our tastings director, and Hannah, who also, you know, tastes a lot of the wine, and been tasting a bunch of Cabernets and Sauvignon Blancs, and the Sauvignon Blanc list came out. And, you know, it's great to see that there's so much diversity still in Sauvignon Blanc for such a grape, I feel like, that's known for, by most consumers, for just one kind of style that was really defined by New Zealand. Mm-hmm. It's really cool to see there's so many different styles for tons of different drinkers. And so I think what this list really shows for people who maybe didn't think Sauvignon Blanc is for them is that there's a lot of different varieties out there to sample, so that there really is something for everybody. And I appreciated the diversity in the wines that were selected.
Definitely. And I think the interesting thing to me about this list too, and about Sauvignon Blanc, is like, you know, you talk about the primacy of New Zealand or its kind of outsized role. And it's definitely well represented on the list. But to me, the interesting thing is, in a way, how the other side of that, the French side of it, and in particular Sancerre, because it's sort of skyrocketed in price, has struggled, I think, to remain a part of the conversation. I mean, it's not a luxury brand in the way that we talk about some other things, but it remains almost like a lot of people don't think about it as being a Sauvignon Blanc wine. They don't even gravitate towards it in the same way. And I think that's been sort of good and bad for Sancerre and has given space for some of these other appellations in France and other countries that produce Sauvignon Blanc to kind of grab some of that market share that for people who want, like Sauvignon Blanc, don't necessarily want at least stereotypical New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc, but can't stomach the price of Sancerre, which is kind of like me, candidly.
I agree. So what we wanted to talk about on this very special Friday is, another episode in which we bring you the receipts, ladies and gentlemen, in which we let you know that, the reason you listen to us is because we've really got our finger on the pulse and we're always looking at the industry with a very critical eye. And so what do we want to talk about? Well, what we want to talk about is that in March of 2024, another publication finally decided to say that Piquette is not a thing. Now, to remind all of you about Piquette, we've brought on our managing editor, Tim McCurdy, who wrote a piece, well over 2 years ago now, about the fact that Piquette was not a thing. But it seems that a few winemakers who have been making Piquette and were big believers in Piquette and were big promoters of Piquette have now decided, because they can't sell Piquette because it never was something that people were interested in, that it is no longer a thing, and they want to go be public about the fact that it's no longer a thing. And there was a whole piece in another publication that people are now sharing, being like, oh my God, what happened to Piquette? And the reason we want to talk about this is not just to, again, bring out the receipts, but is to sort of talk about why it never was going to be a thing in the first place. And I think this is a really good example, again, when we talk about the bubble of, as a operator, producer, people that cover the industry, what we try to do a lot is remove yourself from that bubble to try to understand the actual trends in the drinks world. Because I think the problem often becomes that when you follow these trends that happen based on a lot of times larger publications that are in the lifestyle space that actually don't have a drink specialty, right? They write a few drink stories a year. These publications are ones like Vogue, Esquire, GQ, Vanity Fair, etc., right? If you followed those trend pieces where they finally have someone who writes about Piquette, New York Magazine, right? Sorry, New York Mag, but I had to do it. You wind up actually doing yourself a disservice because you start to believe that there's all this hype out there, but you're not actually looking at the facts and the data to truly understand if that hype is manufactured and smoke and mirrors or actually real. So, Tim, welcome to the program.
Yes, hello, hi. Beaming in from July 2021 over here.
Yeah, so I would love for you to tell us a little bit about that piece and sort of what's gone on since. So, and maybe refresh some people's memory, because I would assume that a majority of our podcast listeners don't even remember what the fuck Piquette is, because why would you? But why don't you just take us back to that time of July 2021 and really, really set the stage for us.
Yeah, so I think it's worth noting, first of all, here, that this was definitely something, as is often the case, that came out of our editorial discussions and editorial meetings. And, I think we'd started to notice a lot of these pieces at the time that are also referenced in the newer version or new publication of this this kind of take, which was that we were seeing a lot of people calling Piquette the drink of summer. And of course, Piquette, we can get into a little bit more. It's not wine, it's pomace. So everything that's left over once grapes have been pressed, water is added to that. You're probably pitching some yeast and maybe adding a little bit of sugar. You're fermenting it to around 7-9% alcohol. Then you're bottling that. If you want an even easier analogy, it's like taking someone's used tea bag and soaking it again and drinking it, and there's your drink.
Yeah.
So yeah, lovely. Really, really nice thought, that one. But no, this came out of an editorial discussion where we'd seen that a lot and we were like, this is just crazy. And I think I want to call out here too, this is kind of a testament to something that has always been my experience when I've been at VinePair, and definitely driven by yourself and Josh, Adam, which is that, you know, you've never been willing for us as an editorial team to take a stance on something if the data simply can't back it up. And I know some people might not like that. They might say, well, this is a trend, it's just a smaller trend. And we're saying, well, something can't be the drink of summer if there's no data to prove it. So we poked holes in all these different ideas or reasons for which it was being proclaimed as the drink of summer. We did that back then. And I think kind of reading back on that piece, much of what we said then has borne out to be true, or was repeated in this newer article.
Right. I mean, basically, right, we said, first of all, there weren't that many producers of it to begin with. The flavor profile was incredibly polarizing. Nielsen, it was such a small product that Nielsen wasn't even tracking it, right? Mm-hmm. I love the quote where you call a spokesman for Nielsen and they didn't even know what it was.
No, that was someone at UC Davis, I think.
Oh, yes, UC Davis, where you had to educate him on what Piquette was before you wanted to understand whether or not it was more sustainable. A lot of the arguments people made for the liquid, that it was a more sustainable liquid, were kind of proven to be untrue, right? Because you're actually using a lot of water in order to create the drink, then you're using more packaging, etc., and then you're doing the same thing you would have done with the pumice to begin with, which is composting it. So mm-hmm. you're wasting more than just making wine. I think a lot of this proved to be true, which is really interesting. And I'm curious from Zach's perspective, right, Zach? Mm-hmm. Like, did you ever see it to the level that we saw it in New York?
I mean, I think it depends on where I was looking, right? You know, part of the story kind of Piquette's, whether you want to call it rise and fall or just never doing much of anything in the first place, has to do with a thing we've also covered a lot on the podcast, which is the diminishing interest and kind of excitement around natural wine, because the two were often, you know, even if you wouldn't necessarily say, you know, you could theoretically make Piquette out of any remaining pomace, could be the most conventionally farmed, you know, grapes out there. Often the two of them were being produced by, you know, the people who were making Piquette, who were pushing Piquette, were deeply in, or at least adjacent to, the natural wine paradigm. And I think part of the reason why Piquette never really ascended, and certainly has not gone anywhere of late, is that people in general are disinterested in natural wine. They're not interested in flawed wines, funky wines, stuff that doesn't taste good, frankly. And Piquette's biggest problem, from my perspective, wasn't that people didn't know what it was. It wasn't that there wasn't a lot of it out there. It's that Tim used the, you know, second attempt at a teabag analogy. It tasted like not very interesting, watered down, funky wine. And like, who really was excited about that, especially when many of these bottles carried, you know, not insignificant price tags? That was, you know, one of the things that surprised me the most about it, is like, Piquette's origins in history have to do with trying to wring one more little something out of a crop that you've already grown and pressed and turned into the thing you're really trying to make. And whether it was something that you could give to your field workers or have on hand to kind of, you know, give people something else to drink, it was never intended to be a premium product. And people's attempt to turn it into such was, I think, even if it wasn't portrayed this way, it was kind of transparently a way for them to profit twice from the same product. And hey, look, it's hard out there making wine. It's a tough business. I get it. But I think in the end, people kind of felt like, why am I paying $15, $20 or more for something that is essentially like the leftovers? Like, that's just a tough sell.
But there were a lot of influential people in wine that jumped on this, as well as other publications, including the one that we are discussing, that finally wrote a piece this past week on the fact, saying that Piquette was dead, basically. They were one of the champions that it was going to be the drink of summer. And so I guess I'm curious for us to have a discussion even more about like what this says about, you know, the bubble wine culture. Mm-hmm. And because I think the majority of people I talk to seem to really be trying hard to convince themselves that it was a good product. Do you know what I mean? Like, it was like, oh yeah, like gritting their teeth and choking it down. And I don't understand why that seems to be something that continues to happen at least over the last, I'd say, decade and a half in wine, especially in the cities, you know, of New York, Seattle, San Francisco, LA, Chicago, right? Like, why is that continuing to happen? But then out of the other side of the same group of people's mouths, they complain and don't understand why people aren't drinking more wine. And I feel like they already have the answer in front of them, which is, well, you're complaining that people aren't drinking any wine, but then you're refusing to give them shit that's delicious they will actually like.
Yeah.
So that's why nobody's drinking wine. And then you are, you know, pushing a product and trying to convince them that it's the better product. I mean, the best quote I saw around that time was a few people, including a wine journalist based in Los Angeles, or a wine personality based in Los Angeles, who had said it was better than White Claw and the next White Claw. And I'm sorry, it just isn't. Think about whatever you want to think about with White Claw. The White Claw tastes good to most people. If it tastes like pineapple, it tastes like lime, right? Like, that's what we're looking for. And I think what a lot of people said about Piquette, and Tim wrote in the article, is like, a lot of the Piquettes taste like rotten fruit. They don't taste good. They taste funky. They taste like kombucha. Like, they don't taste like that drink that then everyone was telling you would consume multiple ones of over the course of an afternoon hanging out in the sunshine. Like, that doesn't sound delicious to me. But again, this is my long-winded way of saying, like, I am curious if you both think, and Tim having reported this piece, you know, back in 2021, this is just so emblematic of the way this part of the industry has always behaved, and the part of the industry that for whatever reason seems to continue to have a large mouthpiece that people seem to listen to without questioning.
Yeah, so I think my kind of conclusion at the time, and revisiting it today, I was like, oh yeah, this still tracks today, and this is probably the thing that always tracks, is that what we saw with Piquette, and it's not only Piquette, right, but it's just another example of a certain segment of wine industry professionals championing something that, not because it's delicious, because it's challenging to most palates, or challenging to people who don't have experience with it. You go from natural wine to Pet Nat to Piquette because it's this even, I mean, it's a weaker flavor, right? And it's inherently funkier because the pH rises during fermentation because, you know, you don't have as much acidity in there. So these off flavors can develop. So it's a challenging flavor profile. And first of all, then that gives you the currency of being able to say, wait, what do you mean you haven't heard of Piquette? And then you give it to someone to try and you're like, wait, what do you mean you don't like Piquette? This is the next big thing. It's great. And so it's just another level of elitism, but rather than wearing blazers and pins and pouring $400 bottles of Napa Cab, you know, we're just the cool kids pouring something that's similarly obscure or not appealing to most drinkers. I have one extra layer of the theory here that, you know, I don't know whether we'll get into later, but, you know, you were speaking about, well, how does this small bubble essentially have this bigger kind of audience and microphone. And you mentioned too that a lot of the articles that we mentioned were written by lifestyle publications. Mm-hmm. I don't have proof for this, but my theory would be that within those publications, you don't have a dedicated food and drinks department. You might have someone who cultures style or culture or things like that, and they're covering a wide umbrella. I would assume that these articles are typically assigned to the person who's developed an interest in these things. So you get into wine, and what happens when you get into wine? Well, 9 people out of 10 might follow who they believe to be the cool kids in wine, which at this time would have been the natural wine crew. So you have one person writing it who maybe doesn't have a background in wine, or that's not their specific focus. And then they see on social media what cool people, quote unquote, cool people are pouring and drinking. And then they pitch it to their editor, and their editor is like, great, let's run with this. This is cool. This is different. Oh, we can call it the White Claw. Amazing. And then we run wild with these trends. And I think that's basically how these weird things gain such a platform.
Right. And then the rest of the industry reads this stuff and says, oh shit, should I be making a Piquette now?
Yeah.
Because Vogue wrote a story about it.
I want to add a little bit more cynicism even to this. I think there are two things that happen. I think one is a lot of publications, maybe they were publications that occasionally write on wine but aren't specific wine publications, or even some that do cover the drinks industry, felt like they had missed some of the story around natural wine. Like they'd been slow to it. They hadn't necessarily taken it seriously right away, and they were kind of overly sensitive to missing out on something else that felt like it could be the next best thing. And or a lot of them got kind of like talked into it by, I don't know if it's a publicist, by some of the people who are quoted in these stories who are, if nothing else, very good at self-promotion. And I think a lot of this stuff kind of comes out of, you know, it's also like July of 2021, right? Like, it's a very weird time. People are like, we're in the like, people are just getting vaccinated. People are like talking about going back into the world. Everything feels topsy-turvy. Why wouldn't a like weird product made from the re-fermentation of used grape skins be the thing that people were excited about? Like, who the fuck knew? Everyone had been spending the last year plus in their houses. So I think there was a little bit of that. That's just people, a lot of publications, a lot of writers, a lot of editors were maybe overly credulous towards these claims in a way that, again, as sort of Tim said at the beginning, not to be too like self-congratulatory, but I think it's certainly true that Vinepair wouldn't run a piece like that without some evidence to back it up. Evidence that's not just such and such personality says this is the next big thing, or five producers in California are making, you know, 50 cases each of this product, but like people are buying it. Mm-hmm. People are searching for it. People who work in wine have fucking heard of it. Like, those are pieces of evidence that might have been necessary to support this claim that it would be a trend. And I think that, you know, I don't mean to say that beverage alcohol journalism has gotten so much better since. I think there's plenty of trend shit that gets run with basically no evidence whatsoever. Mm-hmm. But I do think that it's important to point out how when there's no sales data to back it up, there's no search data to back it up, and you're mostly relying on the say-so of people who have a vested interest in promoting this category, it's probably a sign that if it's a trend, you're going to be lucky more than you're right. Mm-hmm. Let's put it that way.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think, look, this goes back to the conversation we had last week about just local journalism, right? Or 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, we see this a lot in just normal journalism as well. Like the budget for fact checking and for actually looking at data at most publications has all but disappeared. Besides, I mean, we take fact checking really seriously, and we, you know, take looking at data very seriously, as Tim mentioned, but like, you know, it's really now at the top publications in the country. And then everyone else is just kind of, especially when it comes to lifestyles, always the first one to sort of get a little lazy with it, right? And just like, oh, well, all these really influential people are saying it, so it must be true, without really looking into how well they're doing. And I think, you know, what's really interesting about this is the movement for Piquette also, I think, really exemplifies how wine, again, it's how wine more than the other two categories, but especially mainstream beer and spirits, can be really defensive and mean when anything's ever questioned. So if we go back to 2021, I mean, we got a lot of hate for that article. We had a lot of people come for us, and, you know, all we were doing was questioning something, in the same way that we've also very publicly questioned high alcohol, high oaked Napa cabs, right? We also wonder why those are the, you know, wines that continue to be made when there's a consumer demand for lower alcohol and, you know, more fruit and less oak, right? So like, I think we try to play it fair on both sides, but this group was very, very aggressive with their questioning. And it's always also really been mind-boggling to me, because there seems to be such a resistance to like selling things that people actually want to drink. Well, I just don't get it. Like, you know, we'll talk about it, my Vegas trip a little bit more on Monday, Zach, but like being at the restaurant and bar show and meeting people from all across the country, like, you know, the majority of people that attend that show are not from the big cities. They're from second tier cities and then large towns. And they all just want to have a restaurant and bar that's successful.
Yeah.
And so they only care about what people want to drink. And it's really interesting during the session Josh and I gave about just the biggest trends in drinks right now. At the end, we had a question from a young man who was a bartender that was opening a bar in a city, in a large city for the state he was in. And he wanted to do pre-prohibition with his friends because they, you know, had been bartenders at other places and gotten really into craft cocktails. And he was curious if the decision to not sell vodka was a good one or not. And not only did we say, no, it's a terrible one because you're going to piss off consumers, but you should have heard the room. They're like, don't do it. Don't do it. You know, have vodka. And like people all with creative examples for where he could feel stay true to himself and his vision, but also still have things consumers want to drink. You know, people saying, well, you know, you can the drink that your martini can just be a gin martini. But if someone asks for vodka, you still have it behind the bar. You could make them a vodka martini, but you can say your menu is pre-prohibition.
Yeah.
Right. But then you can make any. And it's like, again, because and I feel like we talked about this as well, like the spirits industry seems to, and by that I mean bartenders, understand that they ultimately want to make money. And this, and Piquette is just such a perfect example for me of the wine industry, especially the influential members in certain cities who, as Tim said, had large Instagram followings, etc., like don't really care if you like it or not. They almost like want to challenge you. And if you want to push back, you must not get it. There must not be something that you – there's such this desire to be this like very insidery crowd that doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And then the only time they kind of like backtrack on it is often if they move into becoming winemakers themselves and realize, oh, shit, this actually doesn't sell. I probably shouldn't make this anymore.
Yeah.
Well, and like there's the fundamental difference between having to sell – you know, you run a wine program or you have a retail shop and you have to sell two cases of Piquette. It's another thing to be like, I'm making 500 cases of it and oh shit, no one wants it. And like we have seen a lot, as you said, that the rubber tends to meet the road economically and, you know, sort of stylistically when you have to suddenly find an audience for your wine and your audience can't just be, you know, 50 other cool kids in other parts of the country because in the end, they also have to sell that shit. And if no one really wants it, like you're probably doing something wrong. And yeah, no, I think that's a great point. And it's funny, you know, the conversation around the bubbles and kind of how they form, you know, I think we talked a little bit about the media one here, and I think it overlaps with the sort of sommelier, wine influencer, winemaker even circles. And I think that, you know, it's one of the great examples in the story of Piquette to kind of talk about why it's important to whether you're a journalist or whether you're a producer, a retailer, a somm, whomever, to really make sure that you are trying to listen to a number of different voices. It's not that you shouldn't listen to those people. Like sometimes it can be important. They can be sometimes on trend before other folks, or what they say or what they're kind of pushing out there can have resonance. It can be stuff that people do want to drink, but it can't be the only place you look and it can't be the only place you listen, or else you're getting a very incomplete picture.
Yep.
Well, it was, I mean, this is the thing about it as well, though. I mean, it was just completely inaccurate, the reporting, because, you know, it's not that we're saying that this shouldn't be the drink of summer, but as we mentioned at the time, and July of 2021, summer 2021, absolutely was Piquette's zenith. No one was saying it wasn't. It just wasn't going to be the summer of Piquette, because in New York City at the time, one distributor or an analyst told me that there were 20 SKUs available in New York City. That was it. And at the same time, there were 80 meads available. So what did that mean? That mead was four times bigger than the drink of summer? I mean, it was just preposterous. But, you know, something both of you touched upon that I want to bring us back to briefly here is that, Zach, you said, remember, it was summer 2021. It was a weird time. It was. And in this conversation of data, we have to remember, too, that no one wanted hard seltzer to happen. All these people, all these people who were, quote unquote, serious beverage pros didn't want hard seltzer to happen. First of all, they said that it's a summer fad. Guess what? Then January 2020, VinePair publishes an article with data, a data-driven article proving that hard seltzer was so much more than a summer fad or just a summer drink. People were drinking it year-round. Wine professionals specifically were so keen to have us move on from hard seltzer because spirits got in on it. by way of High Noon or other brands, but vodka-based flavored seltzers. These were being made by breweries, so beer was getting some of the action, and wine was out there in the cold. So why were they so excited to promote Piquette? Because finally they could enter the hard seltzer conversation, or they thought they could. But again, as we said, it just categorically wasn't the case. Had to get that off my chest.
No, that's a really, really good point. And I think, again, sort of shows what was happening at the time. And, you know, I think to bring us home here, I think there probably is some place for Piquette in the market, depending on where you live and what your drinker's into. If, you know, if you live in a real crunchy area and people like kombucha, maybe they're like the new Piquette. But I think the other thing that this shows is with some of these categories, right, there's enough of the category for just one player in most markets, right? In the same regard, right? So for example, I think that if we were to ask, Wild Arc has been successful enough. I don't know how successful, but successful enough that, you know, they're the ones that claim to have revived Piquette. I think if you see a retailer that has Piquette in New York, it's mostly them. There's not really room for anyone else once you have theirs. In the same way that, like, at most bars, I'm going to pick on my other favorite people I like to pick on right now, there's room for one cider line. And that's about it. And that's because the majority of consumers aren't really that into cider. There's a group of people that are, and bars that have that group or need that gluten-free option, et cetera, know that they should have one line for cider, but that allows for one cider brand. And that's it. And the amount of people then that rush in are never going to be able to compete because there's just not enough demand. And I think that was the same thing for Piquette, is that there was never that demand, but people sort of convinced themselves that there was. And that's why now you hear about all these people who are stopping to make it, have, you know, finding places to dump it, et cetera, because like the market was
never
really there.
Or they're rebranding it as anything but Piquette. They're calling it Spritzer or whatever. Exactly. Which I think is, I mean, good on you, I suppose, but you know, woe betide the consumer who picks up a bottle of something that they think is going to be like fresh and fruity and bright, and it's Piquette.
Maybe maybe they can add it to this year's pomace and just make a re-Piquette. Who knows? But No, I just want to say something here too, because obviously I know Zach will probably include the link to our piece in the description there, but not all folks are going to be able to make it over there, or you know, it might pass them by. So just so that we don't sound like three old men or whatever, you know, complaining about nothing, I want to bring in some objective truths here, and let's all add to these. But first of all, you know, this is touted as the drink of summer because it's a sessionable. It's 7 to 9% ABV.
That's not sessionable
in anything. Also, people are talking about how it's sustainable. There's a lot of reasons why this is actually no more sustainable, but yes, you're reusing the pomace, but then you still have to get rid of it. So it's not that sustainable. And the third reason I want to point out here, you guys can add more, is just that it's actually very expensive. So I was doing a look earlier today, and you either have one 375 milliliter can for $10 on average, or a four pack of 250s, so 8 ounces. A four pack of 8 ounce cans, 7 to 9% ABV, for roughly $35. And we were getting pissed off about craft beer doing $20 four packs of 16-ounce cans. This isn't affordable. This isn't like a cheap alternative. So those are some objective truths about why this simply isn't a good fit for the drink of summer.
Well, and I think you mentioned the ABV, and I think we found that for basically everything except for double IPAs, that 7 to 9% ABV is like the worst zone to be in as a beverage, because you're not sessionable, really. But you're also not full flavor. And, you know, it's like another time we'll talk about, and I think we've talked about on the pod recently about how like low ABV isn't really a thing. Like people want yes, but they don't necessarily want low ABV versions of their favorite beverages. And I think that's probably another thing besides the flavor profile is just like, in the end, if you're in drinking to have the alcohol in there, yeah, I don't think that 7 to 9% is a good spot to be in, especially when it comes with all the other stuff that Piquette does.
So just, you know, reminder, we have receipts. We pull them out.
And we won't be, we'll be very glad to show them to you.
They're in a shoebox in Tim's basement. But we pull them out every once in a while.
Zach's the only one in this podcast who has a basement. We've established that recently.
That's fine. They're in a shoebox somewhere in the Vinepair office, but that's where our receipts are.
That's your accountant's problem.
We don't throw them away. We're going to let you know. But, and you know, but I feel like if you're a listener of the podcast, you know. You know. And you also know that, you know, we like to talk about the predictions we make, right? We also talk about the ones we make wrong. I'm happy to have an episode about the ones we've gotten wrong in the past. But, you know, we do get it right every once in a while here at Vinepair. And we, you know, we just want to set the record straight when we do. So, Tim, thanks for coming on and talking about your article from now, wow, like 3 years ago. Yeah, let us know what you think about PCAT. Did you ever drink it? Did you dump it down the sink like we did? Cool. Let us know. Hit us up at podcast@vinepair.com. And Zach, it'll be just me and you on Monday, buddy.
Sounds great.
Thanks so much for listening to the Vinepair Podcast, the flagship podcast of the Vinepair Podcast Network. If you love listening to this show, or even if you don't, but I really hope that you do, as much as we really do love making it, then please drop us a review or a rating wherever it is that you get your podcast, whether that be iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, anywhere. If you are listening to this on a device right now, through an app, however you got this audio, please drop a review. It really helps everyone else discover the show. And now for some totally awesome credits. So, the Vinepair Podcast is recorded in our New York City headquarters and in Seattle, Washington, in Zach Chabal's basement. It is recorded by Zach, mastered and produced by Zach. He loves all the credit. Keep giving it to him. Drop his name in the reviews. He's going to love hearing how much you love him. It is also recorded in New York City by our tastings director, Keith Beavers, who is the managing director of the entire Vinepair Podcast Network. I'd also love to give a shout out to our editor-in-chief, Joanna Sherino, who joins us on every single podcast as our third and most important host. Thank you as well to the entire Vinepair staff and everyone who's been involved in making Vinepair as special as it's become. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next week.